ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
One way or another, NATO's pretty kaput, but the idea that Donald Trump would sort of officially say, well, we're walking away, would just have the most dire ramifications for all of Europe and the rest of us.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
As the Prime Minister continues his hardline rhetoric on so-called ISIS brides, opposition leader Angus Taylor has taken things a step further. The coalition is set to introduce a bill that would make it illegal to assist Australians with links to Islamic State return home. And while the Prime Minister was quick to dismiss the move, Attorney General Michelle Rowland didn't completely shut the door on the idea, which points to some of the sensitivities in Labor on these issues of terrorism and immigration. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Claire Armstrong.
And Claire, you're keeping the chair warm for Jacob, who's deep in the heart of the Farrer electorate, where the Prime Minister has been very active today.
Yeah, he's doing some proper boot leather journalism. He's out on the hustings.
He's talking to the people.
Before a by-election's even been called.
Well, there you go. I'm sure he'll get all sorts of vibes. I'm really intrigued, actually. Anyway, I can't pick his brain because he's not here. But about whether there is a sort of anger at the sort of rolling of Susan Lee, and then the anxieties on lots of other issues, how immigration is playing out, how Angus Taylor is playing out, this independent who did very well in the last real election where Susan Lee won the seat again. Anyway, they're all the questions I have, and we'll get into it. But Claire, the Prime Minister's been pretty busy on local radio stations, which is one of the approaches he takes, isn't it, with his communications?
He loves a local radio station interview.
He likes someone called Wacko and Jacko and, you know, like someone with, yeah, sorry.
It is true. He has a penchant for the FM radio host nicknames, but it's fascinating, isn't it? He walks into those interviews and can be asked anything from, you know, get an absolute battering about the cost of living to, would you like to be buried with your dog Toto one day? But on this occasion, he was obviously just, I think, playing a bit of mind games. You know, he's appeared in Farrer. Labor have not in any way yet indicated that they are intending to run a candidate, and traditionally tend to not in by-elections where they're not really considered a chance. This is very much kind of coalition, you know, country, territory, not really that of the Labor Party traditionally. But for him to pop up in Albury, which is obviously the main city in Farrer, and then do all of these radio interviews, I thought was as much about just sending a message. He does always say, to be in his defence, that he likes to govern for all of Australia. That's like one of his favourite lines. So I guess he just happened to decide to demonstrate that on the eve of a very difficult by-election for his political opponents.
He likes to govern for all. You know who used to say that? John Howard. He's a Labor version, let me tell you. It's a smart thing to say. I mean, they all say it and believe it, but there's a particular way that he says it and I believe acts it, which is interesting. So just on the impending by-election, do we actually know any more about what's going to happen there? Like Angus Taylor, is he going to save that piece of furniture and keep it in the coalition or the Liberal pile?
It is a fool's errand, I think, at this stage to try and judge the outcome. What I'm hearing is not for sure, but it doesn't look like Susan Lee will be returning when Parliament resumes. She's not looking to do a valedictory speech, potentially felt like she said or she had to say in her speech after losing that leadership ballot a couple of weeks ago. She spoke quite broadly then about her parliamentary career, really didn't focus as much on the leadership. So if that happens, you have to assume she's going to actually formally resign within this week, really. That sets the trigger for when we will have an idea of full, like, when the date of this by-election is going to be. We know that the Nationals are running a candidate. We know that the Liberals are running a candidate. One Nation, there's an independent who ran last time, who's thrown her hat into the ring. There's been talk of actually an independent who sits in that area at a state level, also weighing up their options. So we're looking at a 3, 4 or 5 corner race before Labor even enter it. That is tricky terrain for any political leader. For it to be the very first test for Angus Taylor, I think he would be sweating it a bit, because this is a seat that has had for a very long time a Nationals MP prior to having a Liberal one, and both those two parties feel quite an affinity with that seat. It is actually where the Liberal Party was essentially founded in the sort of modern sense of the party, where Menzies brought all those groups together. It is also where I think probably one of our longest serving deputy prime ministers in Tim Fischer, a Nationals MP, sat. So both have this real historical connection to it, a lot on the line in the modern political context of challenging One Nation. So I'm really fascinated and won't be placing any bets at this stage.
But the independents, you know, and obviously they're all separate, but they are very supportive to each other, the tealish independents. And I know, for instance, David Pocock's going there later this week to support the independent. I just think they're going to throw everything at taking it out of the coalition column, and also potentially saving it from any One Nation upset, which I still think is more unlikely. That's my view. I don't know. There's a lot more to play out, which is, you know, your point is right. But I just think, yeah, I'd be watching out for the independent more than anything.
Well, preference flows would be fascinating. And, you know, you've written today a bit about the influence that One Nation is having on both sides of politics. Fascinating to me that Anthony Albanese really struck out on a limb and went, the coalition, both parties have to put One Nation last on their preference, you know, for the ballot for this by-election. That could be hugely instrumental in determining who actually wins.
So let's go to the story that's been kicking around now and has many manifestations and angles. But we talked a little bit in the party room, I also wrote the column you referred to about this on the ABC website, but just how much, and this is my view from conversations, but also my own surmising of things, One Nation's rise is now driving some of the hardline politics we're seeing around immigration, terror, a range of things. So when I say One Nation is framing it, I mean literally that. I don't think it's as literal as One Nation's vote's gone up, Labor's decided to change a policy, because I don't think it's quite so cause and effect. But it's pushing everything to the right and everything more hardline because of what voters are expressing through where they're parking their votes to pollsters. So the Prime Minister has been so hardline in his rhetoric about the so-called ISIS brides, yet it's not good enough for the coalition, and there's a reason for that. They've decided that in chasing these votes that are moving to One Nation, they need to keep outdoing the government. Now, the government has for a long time tried to neutralise issues of border security and terror and not wanted to sort of give any indication that it would be a soft touch. The Prime Minister has hardened his rhetoric. But now the coalition's come up with this idea. Just walk me through it, Claire. Like the idea, they're going to have a bill, just for those who, you know, don't follow the process quite as closely as us. Their bill is largely meaningless other than to put pressure on the government and to create an impression that they're weak.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're so right in saying that the government's language and the PM's in particular has really hardened on this issue, even compared to when they've had to deal with the repatriation of IS-linked families before. And what the coalition are seeking to exploit with this proposal is that there's been a hardening of rhetoric, but there hasn't necessarily been a move legislatively to match that. So they feel they've identified a gap here, which is essentially almost a loophole, if you will, of you can say as many times as you want that you're not assisting these people to return to Australia, that you don't want them to return. You think, you know, as the Prime Minister has been saying, they've made their bed and they have to lie in it. But if they are able to return with assistance from others, then are you really doing everything in your power to stop these people returning as you suggest you want to occur? So the legislation that they're proposing, we haven't seen the bill. I'm not sure if a full bill exists.
It doesn't yet. But
these guys have been in charge for a week. What it would essentially do is criminalise these third parties. And who are we talking about here? It's advocate groups like Save the Children, individuals like Dr. Jamal Rifi. He's been quite a strong advocate for this cohort for over a number of years. Anyone in the periphery who is essentially assisting the return of people who have associated linked with terror hotspots or associated with terror organisations. We actually haven't had a huge amount of clarity from the coalition. There's been some differentiation in even how they've characterised it. We had Ted O'Brien, the new foreign affairs spokesman, sort of saying this is just all part of the slowing down of the return so that it can be well managed. It's not keeping these people out forever, as we know would run into constitutional issues, reminding everyone that these are, again, Australian citizens. And then the other thing is you've had people like Jane Hume sort of suggesting offhand that, well, if you're issuing a passport, are you assisting the return of these people? But of course, I'm not expecting that public servants doing their job and following other laws we have around citizens being allowed to apply for passports would necessarily be captured. So we have a broad idea of where they want to go with this and obviously why it wedges the government. We haven't seen the detail.
No. And when asked actually at the press conference, Angus Taylor stood next to his Home Affairs spokesperson, John O'Dunham. They did a press conference just, a couple of minutes ago. We're recording this on a Monday morning, middle of Monday. And, when asked about the constitutionality of this, they said that's just not an issue for them. Now, that goes to my point about it being a stunt in some ways of just putting pressure on the government, because it doesn't really matter for them, does it? They don't have to care about the consequences. They are literally putting the O back in opposition, right? Because they're like, I don't care. Zero. Get it? Like zero detail. Yeah? Sorry. Just helping you out there. It is this. There's no meat on this bone, right? And also, they talk about exemptions for groups that provide humanitarian assistance. So that implies that Save the Children might fall under there. But then, as you say, there's been other media interviews where it's been implied that maybe they would be, I don't know, that we're getting into pretty dangerous territory here, aren't we? If we can't prove that these women have even broken any laws, remember, Tony Burke spoke to David Spears on Insiders. He talked about the diversity of this cohort. They're not all the same, right? Like, clearly some of them would be more radicalised than others who are really, very much coerced. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's a spectrum in this group. And so you can't have a blunt law, because the blunt law will actually falter in the court. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, it's very easy from opposition to throw an idea up like this, knowing it will never be tested. I mean, the thing is never going to get through the lower house, let alone face a court challenge. A couple of things I thought were interesting in response to this was the Prime Minister, picking up on what you said about the constitutional issues here, highlighting that the reason the laws that do exist, that they have on the books to deal with this, things like the temporary exclusion order to slow the return of an individual that security agencies are concerned about. The reason that it is only temporary, for example, and has a high threshold, it was a law of the coalition government era, was because of the constitutional issues. He sort of has painted this whole proposal from Angus Taylor as quite undercooked, although I did think it was interesting that Attorney General Michelle Rowland was less emphatic in her dismissal of the idea, very much taking, and maybe this is just the legal speak, but taking this broader kind of, well, we have to seek advice on everything. We don't want to fall foul of the Constitution. There doesn't seem to be, from my talking to government, any suggestion that they are moving to amend legislation to deal with this issue. But, you mentioned Tony Burke's interview there with Spearsy on the weekend. It was a great kind of, in the end, in its totality, summation of where the government is at on its response to this issue. What I find is really difficult, and I'm curious as to whether this lasts as a strategy for the government, is trying to get information on it on a complex issue like this, particularly where it strays into national security, particularly in Home Affairs, where Tony Burke has been the minister. He seems to wait until the exact sequence of words is put to him in a way where he knows that he has an answer that he can provide. And you can get quite close. I'm one of the journalists who will help send requests to his office for clarification on points. And if you don't quite word it right, or or in a way that he feels that he has to answer, then he won't. So part of this whole problem is that we're only learning incrementally what actually is the reality of how this cohort is being dealt with. So sometimes the government comes at this from a, you know, they obviously see a much bigger picture than the general public and even journalists see. So the idea that they're on the one hand dismissing the coalition's ideas, but they've got their attorney general out there still saying, oh, well, we're seeking advice, says to me that maybe there is a bigger picture that none of us are getting to see at the moment.
Yeah, that's a really good point. But also, it does go to the sensitivity on this issue. Because of the inflamed politics and the sensitivity, they don't want to provide any impression, again, that they are the weak side on this. And I think context matters. Albanese has been in the parliament for a long time. He's gone through the Tampa, if anyone remembers. Like, he's gone through all of the border security wars that have hurt Labor electorally. Now, this is adjacent. I don't think it's exactly the same. He's also stung by Bondi and his response after Bondi. And then I think he's corrected course. Tomorrow, the Royal Commission officially starts. Virginia Bell will do the opening remarks. This is a, you know, key day going to all of the things he's done to address vulnerabilities on this issue. But I think a lot of it stems from that muscle memory that he has and very senior cabinet ministers, people like Tony Burke, have on these issues. So anyway, watch this space, because there are still, you know, I often think, how is this still kicking around, this story? Like, until, you know, they try to come again and there's more evidence, like, why is this story still so prominent? It's clearly because of the nature, you know, even in, it's in the title, guys, ISIS Brides. I mean, goodness gracious, it's made for the tabloids, isn't it? But equally, today we had the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, talking about their right to an education if they come here. And you know, so it kind of kicks it along, doesn't it, Claire?
Well, I mean, not forgetting that we had a cohort return as recently as sort of September, October last year. So as much as we are having this renewed debate in a much more complex domestic political setting, as you've said, it's really pushed the language and the response to a hard line that didn't exist even under past coalition. You know, there were repatriations under the coalition as there were under Labor in different groups. I think the change in the involvement of the New South Wales Premier kind of stems from that if there is an inevitability to the return of this cohort to Australia, which it seems that there is. I mean, they are Australian citizens residing in a camp that the Kurds who oversee the camp want closed, that the Syrian regime wants closed. So presumably at some point they're going to run out of road, and that puts, in my mind, them most likely on a path back to Australia. Is Minns inoculating himself by kind of clearing off some of the barnacles and addressing a lot of the inevitable questions that will come, which is, if these people arrive at the Sydney airport, obviously there are children in the cohort, what happens to them? I would say that's more him getting on the front foot rather than having any forward knowledge of what might be coming.
Yeah, good point. Look, let's get to the other biggest story in the world, really, which is Donald Trump and his tariffs. Lots of economic woes generally, I think, on the horizon. Sort of that's the broader frame. Then the US Supreme Court struck down Donald Trump's global tariffs decision on Friday. It suggested he exceeded his authority. He's now announced a new baseline global tariff of 15%. He's using a different mechanism. So what that means for us is that our tariff become from 10% to 15%. That's obviously annoying for us. It's pretty obvious because we have to pay a higher tariff. Unclear still, unless you've got an answer to this. I don't, Claire, if beef exports will be immune. And I think the lack of clarity is clear from the government's talk here too, which is that they're getting, they're asking questions.
They are.
They're trying to get clarity.
Well, it just so happens that our Trade Minister, John Farrell, is about to, or maybe even on the plane, on the way to America. This was a very fortunately timed trip, essentially. He was already planning on going over there. So I'm hoping that we will get some clarity around some of those issues. I'm also super interested to see what kind of like hat scarf combination he debuts in DC, having kind of wowed the internet with his appearance in Brussels last week.
But just describe for people who haven't seen this fashionista of a man.
Kind of like a wintry fedora thing. a long trench coat and then like a sweeping scarf. It was full like mafioso. It was an incredible image of like, you know, a real European winter vibes.
And when you said mafioso, I think it's important to remind our audience who think, who's the trade minister, this Don Farrell figure? That in some ways he is mafioso-like in the Labor Party, in that he's
really
controlled
is.
Factions and numbers.
The
and
ultimate faceless man.
The faceless man that knocked off Rudd. And then, he is, historically speaking, very much perfect for that image. What's he going to do? Is he going to fix this problem for us?
Well, I mean, the beef thing is interesting because what we've seen with Trump is where he's come under domestic pressure on products that Americans value, hamburgers being among them, he has relented and done deals to sort of smooth the path for those commodities. That's sort of what we saw with beef. I haven't seen any suggestion that he's rushing to make a McDonald's meal more expensive for his voters. But we don't know. I think Don will be looking to get as much clarity as possible. I mean, the government has had quite a, you know, they've been fairly happy to stay quiet, just saying, you know, we've got the lowest tariff rate in the world with the 10%. I think that rings a bit more hollow when the entire world now is just on the same low rate. But I think he'll be looking for a few concessions there. And then I still feel that the government strategy here is to just keep the advocacy pretty quiet and not do much of the chest beating when it comes to this administration in the US.
I think that's right. And can I say that is generally a strategy which annoys people like us because we can't see
it. We want noise and colour and movement.
Yeah, we want to see it too, right? Like we want to actually see what's happening. But he's often very effective, truthfully, for governments to get things done out of the spotlight. And, you know, I can't believe I'm linking it back here, but I will. There has been a hard line definitely on the ISIS brides, but I've got to say the more publicity it gets, the harder the response you'll see. Don't you reckon? There's a nexus.
Yes.
They may. I think the Prime Minister, I've been briefed, has been hardline on this particular cohort for a while. So I don't think it's brand new. But I wonder if all of those responses would be different if it didn't have the level of tabloid and publicity interest, because you'd be able to do all sorts of quiet work. Now there is no quiet work. Like when there is no quiet work, sometimes things that people might want achieved don't happen. Like, am I right? And the same thing with Trump, rather than sort of getting a nice little deal, megaphone diplomacy on this, I don't think they would see in their interests.
It's fascinating that something that Anthony Albanese would consider his strength, you know, this way he approaches problems considered, he doesn't rush in, he doesn't beat his chest, has somewhat aligned to an extent with how is turning out to potentially be a way to manage President Trump. So his natural tendency has sort of aligned on dealing with this administration, maybe less so on the ISIS brides. And that's why we're seeing this switch now, because he's having to change into a gear that he doesn't often sit in on a lot of issues.
Yeah. Now, Claire, speaking like broadly of the economy, because obviously the only reason the tariff issue is a big deal is the sort of economy and the jobs consequences for our country. But you've also had a look at how state premiers don't seem to be suffering for high spending like the federal government is politically. What do you mean?
Well, certainly not personally. I was actually sitting at the press club in Canberra where Queensland Premier David Crisafulli's, the Liberal National Party Premier, was delivering quite impressively a sort of half an hour off-the-cuff speech. He had about 6 dot points. I know it's probably a lot of what he had said before, but it was new to a national audience. Dealt quite directly with some prickly questions, and it really got me thinking that, and also combined with, as we know, the South Australian state election started over the weekend, where Labor Premier Peter Malinauskas is expected, quite frankly, to romp it in, that we have this situation where these premiers, their personal likability and favourability approval ratings are very high, but they are presiding over governments that are as in debt and economically in strife as their federal counterparts, sometimes worse when you scale it. But they, you know, they enjoy this kind of bubble of approval that is not often visited on their federal counterparts, which I just think is something that maybe, you know, in a post-COVID universe where I think the Commonwealth learned pretty comprehensively that taking on the premiers every single time. The public is going to go with their local premier rather than the prime minister, as Scott Morrison found out to his detriment over a lot of those COVID battles. There's this reticence to criticise the activities of these state governments, these premiers who are hugely popular, that then the federal government has to pay for, both in terms of its own, you know, favourability and ranking and approval, but the ability it has to oversee the economy. Inflationary things include housing approval rates, public service, public sector wages, the sequencing of the infrastructure pipeline, all things that the states have predominant control over. So I wrote a piece. I think it's interesting that maybe it might be time for some of their federal counterparts to start pushing back just a little bit when it comes to who's truly responsible for this economic narrative, because otherwise the premiers are really just dining out on a free lunch there.
They love a free lunch. Never get in the way of between a premier and a big, you know, bag of money is the sort of cliche. Claire, thank you for standing in for Jacob and making my Monday a political feast. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I can't wait to hear about his adventures in the mighty seat of fact.
Yeah, I know. He'll probably come back with a new shirt and outfit. That's really what he's...
No, he's supposed to have mud on his boots. It's a regional electorate.
I'm sure he'll throw some mud on himself, just, you know. That's it for Politics Now today. Tomorrow, I'll be joined by Claudia Long to bring you the latest developments in politics. If you've got a question, send it to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Fran and I will answer it. See you, Claire.
Bye.